Hi, everybody. I'm Hugh, and I'm an alcoholic. I love y'all too. I love y'all too, and this is good to have here because it's so calm me. You made me forget everything I was thinking. I appreciate it, Ray. That was you almost got me crying over there. I think I just forgot my story, which is like my greatest fear. I'll get up here and go blank, and so I'd have to use somebody else's story. I guess really all I can share with you is what the book says. You know, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. So I'll tell you as much as I remember, and I hope that that suits you. First, I just want to thank, I don't want to forget to do this. I want to thank the host committee for inviting me because this is a huge privilege. I think this is my 15th Tiki Paw in a row to be at, and so to say it means a lot to me is an understatement. So this is a great privilege, and I hope I don't screw it up because it's going to be on CD. For everybody to bring back up to me, and I can't deny it. I was born at a very young age. I was born in Savannah, Georgia in 1970 to an alcoholic family who was from a long history of alcoholics. Actually, this is true. It's historically noted that we have a family member who actually fell off the Mayflower, and it's like in history books. And I don't know if he was drunk, but I can bet you that was behind it. So that gives a little indication. All four of my grandparents died of alcoholism. My mother's father died actually 2 years sober making coffee in a meeting. So we had some AA history too. I didn't know that about my grandfather. I used to remember he had lost his leg to alcohol-induced diabetes, and he would come into town to visit, and we would take him over to this place in Nashville called 202 Friendship House. We'd drop him off there, and he'd go to meetings. I had no idea what that was all about, but it's kind of sweet, you know, that years later I would end up there, you know, and remember pulling in and dropping my granddad off. So both of my parents are alcoholics. I can't sit here and say, you know, that I was just terribly abused and terribly treated and grew up on the streets and all this, because that wouldn't be true, you know. My parents were alcoholics, fairly high-functioning alcoholics. I can't blame anything that's happened in my life on my family situation except for possibly that this thing was kind of handed down through the generations. I moved here with my sister, who's 2 years older than me, when I was 5 years old. I understand from my parents it was due to a geographical cure. My dad had gone to college in Nashville, which is where I live. Give it up for my peeps from Nashville. Okay. We moved to that was on CD, peeps. Give it up. Right. Exactly. Yeah, go back further for that. We moved to Nashville because my father had gone to college here. My dad had lost his business in Savannah, so, you know, better things, better places, you know, move along. It's anybody's fault but his. And, you know, that kind of thing. Good alcoholic thinking, you know. So we moved to Nashville, loaded up everything pretty much we owned in a car and moved here. And I truly believe today that I was an alcoholic from the word go. Just, you know, I have no evidence to support that except for the fact that the looking back on it, my thinking and my behavior always was alcoholic. I was 5 years old. I moved here. I went to kindergarten. I went to parochial schools, Catholic grade school, and Yeah, for a long time. And I did kindergarten twice there. I failed kindergarten. Anybody in here? I couldn't get the blocks right, I guess. My mom says that I was not mature enough to move on, and I don't know what that takes, you know? But I didn't have it. And that should have been like an immediate warning sign. But immediately, you know, moving here, and as far back as I can remember, you know, there was the world out here, and then there was the world in here, you know? And I heard somebody give it a fancy word one time, cognitive dissonance, you know? And that is reality is here, and my reality is way diametrically opposed, okay? And so I had this world going on in my head, and it was where I would kind of go to feel okay. And the first time I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous the analogy of the alcoholic being having the hole in the soul fit me to a T from the very time I can remember, the earliest time in my life I can remember. I always felt like that there was a hole in the middle of me with the wind blowing through. And there was always an abundance of fear, loneliness, feeling like alone in a crowd, like nobody understood what went on with me. And so the earliest I can remember, I tried to fill that hole with whatever I could just to feel better. I had this dream world in my head that would try to make everything feel better, to try to calm that fear that always went on with me. They told me today that's a God-sized hole, you know. It's the only thing that fills that perfectly. And I didn't get that until I came to this program. You know, I didn't get that puzzle piece, you know, that fit perfectly until I got here. So I always ran around out there, you know, as even a small child, trying to feel okay. I was a class clown, and I loved to play sports too. And wasn't great in school ever. You know, I did enough to get by. And if that didn't work, I would try to get, you know, use your work to help me get by. But those were things that I loved, and those were things I could escape into and try to use to feel okay, to fill that hole. As if I felt like I could get you to laugh or recognize me in some way, you know, I was okay. And I didn't have the internal resources to have that on my own. I just didn't. And I'm a good example, as most alcoholics are, of the egomaniac with inferiority complex. You know, by all rights, you wouldn't know that I didn't like myself, but it was there. You know, deep inside of me. You know, was all that fear about what you thought of me. You know, or who I was, and also was. Was pretty good in sports, and I enjoyed sports, and I found that some sports that I could excel at, and I felt like that not only did that make me feel better about myself, but I could connect with my father that way. So it was very, very important to me, and I'll come back to why it was important to me later, but I don't actually remember the first time I ever touched alcohol. I think I've heard stories about me as a small child kind of getting into the liquor cabinet and drinking, but I don't count that. I think I can remember, you know, being real small and trying it out and experiencing it, getting sick, whatever, and I didn't go back to it immediately. I do want to say that although I was from an alcoholic family, I never saw my family as alcoholic. I never knew what that meant. My family, I thought was normal, you know, and I guess I thought every family acted like that. You know, my family always kind of got by. I was never, you know, there was never, it wasn't a lot of police calls, you know, to the house or thing, you know, crazy things happening. But my my family consistently got worse as our disease progressed, and we grew further and further apart. And, you know, we didn't exactly communicate on a healthy level. We fought a lot, and we blamed a lot. We did all the stuff a normal alcoholic family does. And but I thought we had a pretty normal Catholic family, you know. I thought, you know, and I guess some of the other families that I was around were very similar. But looking back on it in retrospect now, you know, I got scared about people coming over to stay with me, you know. I can remember being embarrassed, you know, and having to cover up, you know, for my family and stuff like that. I can remember fights going on, arguments where I would put my pillow over my ears, you know, so I could try to go to sleep. Or I would go peek down the stairways to make sure everything was all right, you know. But those, I blocked those things out, I guess, because I think I wanted everything to be normal. And that's back to that world that I created in my head. And it took a long time for me in sobriety to really truly find the true from the false, because a lot of the stuff that I over the years in my life had thought was true was stuff that I had made up just to feel okay. That took some willingness, some honesty, and some open-mindedness to get to that point, and some time for that to happen. I still, honestly, and as I get further in my story, I don't remember a lot of my story, a lot of my drinking, because I did black out a lot. So I have to give you kind of the shortened version, or whatever I can remember. I got in trouble a lot at school as a class clown, you know, and I guess it was worth it, you know. The payoff was worth the risk. You know, that was how bad I felt about myself. Is it didn't matter what the end consequences were, as long as is immediately I felt okay. And again, that's back to that immediate gratification. I would do anything right now just to feel okay in the moment. And I'm gonna kind of get through the drinking history and get on to recovery, because that's where I do like to spend most of my time. I guess I probably remember starting drinking when I was 7th or 8th grade, you know, just periodically. You know, I was maybe 12, 13 years old, sneak here and there. I know that my sister and I, who's here, she was 2 years older than me, and I can remember sneaking around and sneaking alcohol and refilling. You remember that sherry thing that they had in there? We'd refill it, and it would just get, like, lighter and lighter. And we would do that with a lot of alcohol, and that didn't seem abnormal. It seemed real curious. And I know that I said to myself at certain times that I didn't want to be a certain way. I said that I would never smoke, I would never do this, I would never do that. And getting back to that immediate gratification, all that stuff went out the window, just to feel okay in the moment. My sister is a major part of my story and my family's story. Eighth grade, I started drinking more here and there on weekends. I started getting in more and more trouble. I had an extremely bad temper and a real short fuse, and that got me in a lot of trouble. And I almost got kicked out of school my eighth grade year for like attempted assault on a teacher. I picked up a chair, and my coach walked in and grabbed me and took me outside and said, we'll just pretend like this never happened. And I never heard about it again. But it was kind of looming over my head. I had my first blackout that I can recall my eighth grade year. It was the last day of school. They called it field day. And you do all these activities, like three-legged races, stuff like that, you know. It's just – and I went to Dominican nuns were in the school that I went to, and we had to dress in uniforms and all that kind of stuff. I remember we brought in this whiskey in a canteen, and we went back before like the field day started, and we started drinking in this room, and that's the last thing I remember. And except for I can remember kind of coming out of that at my house, and I had all these ribbons where I'd won, like, different events. And I have no idea what the hell they were in, you know, or what I did. I did okay, I guess. But that was the first time, and you know, I guess I thought that was kind of exciting. I didn't really see the fear in that at that point. I try to get my timetable right, but the summer between my eighth grade year and my freshman year, my sister was the current crisis in the family. We had different. It's interesting because, you know, I work in a treatment field, and we have, you know, the roles in the alcoholic family. You know, you have the mascot, and that was, of course, me most of the time. You have the lost child, the scapegoat, the chief enabler, you know, all that good stuff. Anybody that's been in treatment knows the deal. But we played all of them, I think, at one point or another in our family. You know, we took turns in those roles. And Kat was kind of, was the first one to be the scapegoat in the family, you know. Oh, man, she's the problem. But my sister, I don't want to tell too much of her story, but my sister ended up taking off for a period of time, running away from home after she had gotten kicked out of her second high school. And nobody knew where she was, and everybody was looking for her. And my parents had done some investigation into alcoholism and drug addiction. And during that, they found that a treatment center in town had opened an adolescent unit that same year, and they had it all ready for her. And I remember my parents coming up to me, and it was one of those sit downs, okay? And it was during the time that you had run away from home, and they said, "We need to talk." And I thought, "Oh man, here we go." And they said, "We think your sister may have an alcohol and drug problem. What do you think?" And I went, "Yeah, she's absolutely horrible problem." And I was like, "Whew, dodge that one." And but that was true. I did think that, you know. I thought, and that was where I was at. I thought that my sister was out of control, and I thought I was in control, and I thought everything was okay in my life, you know. I was so far from thinking that I had any problem, and I was binge using, binge drinking here and there. Nothing, you know, nothing major. I was still everything. All the pieces in my life were in place, and so to kind of cut the story short, my sister came home, went to treatment, that led to the family program at her treatment center. And the one I work at now, actually. I worked down the hallway from the room I sat in the family program. And it was really strange for a while coming into work and looking down that hallway and thinking, man, did I feel rough. Yeah, because really, I was there to support my sister, but it was a week out of school, okay? And we start talking about all this alcoholism and addiction, and it was just like broadsiding me. And then they started to discuss our problems, and that's where, you know, I didn't see their point. Okay, you lost me there. But what it did for me is it did plant a seed, and it gave me a better understanding of what alcoholism really is. And I had no clue up to that point. I'd never even really given it much of a thought. At that point, I could have told you my family was pretty screwed up, okay, if cornered. But I didn't know what alcoholism was. You know, I guess if you would have asked me, I probably would have said an alcoholic is somebody old, very old, who drinks all day, every day, you know, pushes everything they own around in a cart, and lives on the streets, cardboard boxes. That would have been what I would have told you. And anything short of that wouldn't have been an alcoholic. You know, just like if you'd asked me about a drug addict, I would have said somebody in a back alley sticking a needle in his arm, you know, whatever. You know, I guess I had preconceived notions of what this was, and anything short of that didn't add up. I was way wrong. in my estimation, I guess an adolescent couldn't be an alcoholic, you know. Went through the family program, got enough information to kind of just sit there for a while. My sister ended up getting out of treatment, and Ray told some of that. She was there 45 days or something like that. And she came home, and so did somebody else from treatment that was a friend of hers and lived with us. And it was kind of like we had a little halfway house going for a little while. We had people staying there in early sobriety. And I actually went to some meetings. I went to see her get her 30-day chip and then some other times. And I actually struck up some relationships with some young people. And this was 1985. Some young people, and some of which are in this room, that would be lifelong friendships and are today very, very close friendships. And I really, truly like these people. And I actually stopped drinking and using for a period of time. You know, I was so overwhelmed with the love and what I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the friendships that I wanted a part of that. I didn't think I was one of y'all, you know. But I know now, looking back, I did want what you had. Six or so months after my sister got sober, my father got sober, and then about a month later, my mother got sober. And and the people kept coming to the house and staying sober and being real, real happy. Okay, and that's what I remember, playing lots of spades and being real, real happy. And I was not real, real happy. I was real, real unhappy. I was in and out of just being dry, okay, and that's a lonely, miserable place. You know, that is the hole in the soul without any medication, and it's not any fun. I would also mind you revisit that in sobriety. I'll get to there. I don't know. This is where everything gets sketchy. Okay, at some point. Started drinking again, and I think I had been drinking periodically here and there, you know, kind of not when I was hanging with the program folks. And I remember every now and then things would happen, and all that stuff that I knew would run through my head and make me very, very uncomfortable. And I can remember even driving down the road one day and asking my dad, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And I remember my dad saying, well, just try some controlled drinking. And I remember just sitting there, and I couldn't even come up with the image of me controlled drinking or what that was, what that even looked like. And so I asked him, and he told me, and you know, another bell went off. But it wasn't enough. So I continued to binge drink, and I didn't, you know, one of the things about my sister and feeling so superior is I was not going to be like, you know, out of control. I was going to have things together. I did not get into a whole lot of drug use. You know, I've tried it, used it, whatever. It was great. My true passion, my true love was alcohol. And the moment I touched it, I was in love. And I couldn't tell you what was going to happen. But it probably wouldn't be real good. And that's my history. Let's see, where did I leave off? Soon after the conversation with my father, we had another meeting, and this time it was to discuss me. And I remember them asking me, do you think you might have a problem? And I said no. I said I've thought about it, and this is the reason I don't have a problem, and in my mind I everything was still together, and I remember getting really upset and saying, okay, just to show you I don't have a problem, I will never drink again. And my dad started laughing, and he said, you can't say that. And I said, what do you mean I can't say that? Of course I can say that. And that was the moment that I would try to not drink on Hugh's terms. And I went a few months and just dry as a bone, not admitting I was an alcoholic, just not using anything. And just left with dry old Hugh. And I mean, it was bad. I was angry. I can remember coming in the house and those people there laughing and playing cards. And I just, I hated them. I did. I hated them because I wanted what they had, you know. But I wasn't one of them. At some point, I started drinking again. And this is where my drinking gets really, really short and really, really fast. It lasted for about 9 months, okay? I picked up alcohol, and I didn't put it down for about the next 9 months, and I can't tell you much of anything that happened, except for I was picked up at a lot of places by family members that I can't remember or anything that happened. I got in a lot of trouble. I quit playing sports. My grades dropped. My friends left me. Everybody was just tired of putting up with me. And I can remember being asked to leave friends' houses and not to come back. I can remember my parents being called by lifelong friends of the family saying, you know, your son got John's little brother drunk, and he can't come back anymore, you know, and stuff like that, you know, stuff that I would have to live with. And I did not like the things I was doing. I did not like who I was the times that I was sober. But I, at that point, didn't know what to do. Get to the end of my drink. Well, the summer of 1986, I can tell you very little about it except for I think I had four jobs. I don't know really what they were. I remember I drywalled. I was working with this guy named Julio, who got narcotics from this police department, would sell them, and he was like 40 years old, and I was 16, and he was who I was hanging with. And Julio got me a job that he had gotten some friends together to begin drywalling houses, and I had no idea how to do that or anything about work or manual labor or anything. But we started drywalling, and all I can remember is going in, day out, and we would start drinking in the morning at these houses we were working on. And this one house, I can remember being in this closet for like 3 days. I was trying to drywall a closet. And it was a very small closet. And I was thinking, man, I can't be very good at this. And then the next thing I remember is, you know, you guys are going to need to pack up and go. And we got fired. And we would just try odd jobs. And that summer was real miserable. That summer I had a lot of people close to me that I grew up with telling me things that I didn't want to hear about myself. And all I could do not to feel that was just to drink. And that's all I wanted to do anyway. I couldn't care about anything else. It was October of 1986, just to kind of wind up my drinking. I had started drinking that day, and I went to a concert, and I continued to drink, and the concert was over, and I wasn't done. And I called a friend of mine, this guy, and I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm at the house. Where else did I think he would be? He was always there. This is the guy who always ended up at his house, and we would wait for his mom to fall asleep, and we would drink ourselves into oblivion. And it was a very big house, very big bar, and that's why Hugh was there. And it was the one place where people were not asking me to leave. So I went over there and I started drinking, and at some point blacked out like normal. And the next thing I can remember was opening my eyes in my bed at my house, and not knowing how I got there. And similar things had happened before, but the way I felt was just the worst. It was beyond comprehension. I couldn't move any part of my body. It hurt to open my eyes. And all I could do was sit and listen. And what I heard was my mother, not very happy, on the phone in the other room talking to a family member, telling them what happened. And what had happened is that Hugh blacked out as normal, went to go get sick in the bathroom, and passed out the wrong way, passed out backwards, and started to choke on my own throw up, and to the point where I was beginning to not be able to breathe, and my friend's mother just happens to get up, you know, and go to the kitchen, I guess, to get some water or something. Walks past his room, sees the light on in the bathroom, and finds me, and gets me breathing, and calls my mother, and you know, they come and get me again. And laying in that bed, unable to move, and just, you know, everything in the world running through my head, everything I had ever heard in a meeting from anybody else, you know, right there. And I believe at that moment is when I admitted I had a problem with alcohol. And I don't know truly if I worked the first step laying there, but I admitted enough to get to you know, start this deal. And so I knew I had a problem. I knew the first step. I knew the first step was we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. And a lot of times I hear people in meetings say that they got the first part, it was the second part. Well, I got the second part, okay? But I didn't know about the first one, okay? I knew my life was unmanageable. I mean, my life was unmanageable. And laying there, I realized it had always been unmanageable. I had always thought I was in control. I'd always fooled myself, you know. But I thought I was still too young to be an alcoholic. Looking back on it now, and I've heard somebody say in AA that the longer they stay around this program, the more alcoholic they become. And that's me, okay? This has been a work in progress. However, getting sober, and that was I took my last drink, and actually I don't know the day. It was but my sponsor had me pick a day in mid-October 1986 because I knew it was around there. So my birthday has always been, since you know, my first year of sobriety, October 12th, 1986, and haven't had to take a drink since. And I, you know, getting sober, I was 16 years old, getting sober young, a lot of times people struggle with the fact that, you know, whether they're alcoholic or not. I haven't had a lot of struggles whether I think I can drink successfully again, you know. I've had other struggles with other self-will issues, you know, and thinking I'm in control, and that's that unmanageable part of it. I started coming to meetings again, and this time for me. And I remember I went to 202 upstairs, and I picked up a white chip that night. And I didn't go to treatment, but my high school, I was in a Catholic high school across the street from 202, and my treatment was I lived at 202. They would let me out, like, at study halls and certain times during the day, and I'd go over for a day meeting. And I would always go to my home group, which was the Bellevue Presbyterian meeting, every Tuesday and Thursday. It was my home group. I never missed it. And I went to meetings every night and every day. And when I wasn't in meetings, I was hanging out at 202 with old-timers and a bunch of young people who were really, you know, into sobriety. And that was where Hugh soaked up all the good stuff, you know, and it's where I found home. And that's the one thing I can sit here and tell you is that when I finally admitted that I have a problem with alcohol, you know, and backing up a little bit, when I said that the first part of the first step, see, I believe today that when I admitted I had a problem with alcohol, I believe that wholeheartedly, and I accepted that. It was later that I was to know the true meaning of alcoholism and what all that entails in my life, you know, and truly accepting that in my heart, and what that means to what I need to do in sobriety. I went to a lot of meetings, and and that hole started to close a little bit, and I felt home. You know, it was the first time in my life in a group of people where I could go in there and they were talking my language. Some of the stories and some of the things were different, but they knew me, and that was exhilarating. That was something I had never experienced. And, you know, so I lived in meetings, and I lived, we had a young people's meeting. I lived for the unity and the fellowship in this program. And that got me into the service. It was, in 1986, I had gotten kind of railroaded on a, bid committee for IKIPA. And they were bidding in Boston. I didn't go up there, but they went up there, got the bid. And so in 1987, we hosted IKIPA. And I was young and new in sobriety. 87 we bid, 88. See, dates kill me. 88, we had the conference in Nashville. And I just kind of lowered my head and followed people around. And they told me what to do. But I got to experience through other people, through the unity of the program, how beautiful, working on a conference can be, you know, service work. And I got to see that firsthand, and it was unbelievable. It was unbelievable to see that many people join together to celebrate and help each other in sobriety. And it was huge. We had Opryland Theme Park as our pre-conference event all to ourselves. And it was just awesome. That led to, Ray and I were talking about this earlier, right after that conference, we were so on fire that, we got together a group of people, at Ray's, grandparents' house and we formed, a bid committee for, Tikipa. And, that started kind of our love and our enthusiasm about Tikipa. And we bid about three times and didn't get the conference. But we kept doing it, and we kept having dances, and we kept joining together, and we kept fighting, and it was awesome, and we just didn't stop, and so that was my introduction to service work, and through that got me into service on a home group level, a young people's meeting, and being able to experience the fruits of service work in the program. And I can never be grateful enough for that, but I want to emphasize something, okay? There are three legacies in this program: unity, recovery, and service. And I had two of them down, okay? I did not have the recovery. And I do want to emphasize that, because that's a huge part of my story. I heard somebody say, like, the worst thing they ever did in AA was take the steps out of the book and put them on the wall and leave the directions in there. Because what I did was I would work them off the wall. And I figured because I could read them and conceptualize them and agree with them, meant I worked them. And that is false. And that would not prove to be the essence of the spiritual experience that Hugh needed. That just wasn't going to happen. So the unity and the service got me so far, and it was exciting and it was great. But I had to have more. There had to be what the book calls a psychic change. I had to get in there and start doing some work. So at about 3 years sober, of not having any routine, any prayer in my life, any meditation, working any steps. I do want to say one thing. I did, at 6 months sober, with Ray, work a four-step. And it was the saddest thing I think I've ever done. And it's not Ray's fault, but this was the point of willingness I was at, okay? I was having fun in sobriety. Why rock the boat, okay? Except for I was starting to experience in meetings questions my way about the stuff I was saying, and I wanted to be able to back it up by saying, yeah, I've worked it, you know, because I was real good at running my mouth in meetings about the program, you know, but until I was called on it. And I can remember being about 90 days sober or something and running off for about 20 minutes in a meeting before somebody in my home group said, you've said enough. You've really said enough. You don't have any more to give us that we need to hear. And that was like brutal. It was brutally honest and what Hugh needed. Okay, it wasn't enough because I kept on. But I remember about 6 months, Ray and I were working together, and I said, "Man, I got to work this four step." And so I opened the book to where it had the list in the big book, and this is Hugh in his easier, softer way. You know, Hugh work in his program instead of the program. Okay, I look at the list and I'm like, "Oh, I can do this." You know. And I had been in the book before. It wasn't my first time to see it, okay? But I had not studied it. And I do want to say that it is not a novel that you read through and go, good read, okay? It's a text. You know, I have a guy in my home group that says the first thing he ever did when he got a big book was look in the back to see how it ended, you know? And I did not study it. You know, I did not understand what it meant in my life. And so I sat down and I did, okay, that list. And I went back and I had my moment. Okay, I got alone, got quiet for 45 minutes. And I wrote down all my family members, closest friends, why I was pissed off at them, what they had done, and what it affected. Okay, brought it back, said, done, ready. Read it to them. I said, whew, I feel better. And I didn't even read, you know, after that. And the neat thing is, a couple of sentences later, after it shows that list, it says to conclude that others were wrong is as far as most of us ever got. Okay, damn if I just would have read the directions, you know, if I would have read on. But I was as willing as I was right then. So at about 2.5-3 years into my sobriety, I just really got tired of life, you know. I just thought, this is all there is to it, you know. You know, I'm signing out. And I, you know, too chicken to do anything about it, but I didn't want to live. And I can remember at the end of my drinking, I was at that place, you know. I can remember every night I went to bed, I would have this prayer, God, don't let me wake up, you know. Just, you know, do it the easier, softer way, you know, just let me go off in my sleep. And I was there again, you know, in sobriety. I was miserable, you know. The newness of the program had worn off, you know. I'd been to all the damn dances, you know. I'd played in a million spades games, you know. I had, it just all was old, you know. And so I decided. Well, you know what? I didn't decide anything, you know. It just got real hot on my ass again, that flame. It was real close, and I needed to do something. I needed to do something one way or another. And I can remember this guy in the program that I really respected and kind of feared a little bit because he's pretty rough. But I remember asking him out to dinner, and we were eating, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and I said, and this is the level of humility I had to reach, you know. And I just said, look, I've been sober 3 years and I haven't worked any steps. You know, I've accepted some things in my life, but I haven't done any of the work. And I'm miserable and this is what's going on. He said, well, are you willing, to do the work? And I said, yeah, I'm willing to do something. And so we got together and started from step one and started working through the steps. And my hand and his hand leading me all along the way through the book and pointing out. And that's how it needs to be done. You know, that's how this deal started, was another person guiding another person through this deal and helping them to understand it. And if you're trying to do this by yourself, you're making a fatal mistake. You know, there's a lot of experience around the rooms that is there, that is given to us by God to use, that I believe. And I have to remember that today too, because it's still one of my main problems is trying to do too much myself, trying to do it myself, trying to figure it out. I still want to be self-sufficient, you know, and I guess in the back of my mind, I still think somehow I will be one day, you know, and every now and then, you know, God knocks me down a peg. You know, I get to those points in my sobriety where I start to feel like I've arrived. And I start to want to stay still, and it's impossible to do in this program without going backwards. So I started working through the steps, and you know, I started to get an understanding of this program, and I started to truly understand what surrender means, okay? And the level of surrender that we take ourselves to through the process of the steps, you know? And I started to realize that, the whole purpose of these steps, you know? And it says it in the book, you know? It says where it's talking about insanity, it says, you know, the whole purpose of this book is to help you find that power that you need in your life. You know, I'm missing the quote, sorry. But you know, it's, I don't have the needed power. I don't. And I just needed another level of humility to prove that not only drinking, but life is just too much for this alcoholic. You know, I can do it. You know, I wanted to get sober, and everybody just acknowledge that and be real happy about it and change to suit me. And it talks about that, you know, in the 11th step. You know, it talks about in the big book. It says, you know, we wanted the world to change to suit our needs, when really we were the ones that had to change to suit the world, you know, around us. And I never wanted to do that. I just didn't. I fought it. And there's actually a story of a friend of mine in this room that I always have to tell, because it's fairly stupid, but it means a lot to me. This is a God thing, you know. We hit these points in our sobriety where we're just running on ourselves, and we're just dry, and God's there. And I believe today, every day I wake up, I have the opportunity to have a spiritual experience. I believe that beyond a shadow of a doubt. I believe it's there. I believe the problem is where I'm at, what I'm looking for. Well, at this point in my sobriety, I was not doing well, and I was kind of running the show again. And Ernie and I were going to a movie one night, and we were running a little bit behind, we got to the movie theater, and instead of just rushing into the movie for the movie, I decided to go to the concession stand and get something to drink and some nachos. And so I go to the concession stand, and I got it, and the woman gave me back my nachos, and then there was like all these chips and just this little bit of cheese, you know, and I just got irritated, and it was just, you know, I was already not having a good day. I was late for the movie. It's just one more damn thing to deal with, you know? And I said, ma'am, excuse me. I said, could you please, give me some more cheese, you know, at least equal proportion of chips to cheese, please, is all I'm needing here. So the woman just yanks them, grabs them back. I'm watching her. She walks over to the cheese, and she just starts just dousing cheese on the chips, and it's just like overflowing. And she pushes it back, and I can't even grab this thing. It's just covered with cheese. And I'm like, you bitch, okay? And I'm like, this is over for you. So I say some words to her, and I'm like, and Ernie's like, come on, man, let's go. And I was like, you go to the movie. You know, I'm not, forget the movie. So I'm like looking around, you know, for the door that says private. You know, I'm like, there's a manager working here somewhere. So I'm just banging on this door looking like a complete jerk, all right? And this guy comes out, and he says, yes. And I'm standing there just wild-eyed probably, and I said, this is what your person just did, you know, and I don't know how you train people to treat people here, you know, but he's like, I'm sorry. Why don't you go to your movie? We'll get you another thing of nachos, you know. Movie's on us, you know. The guy was being really, really nice, and I'm like, no, that's sorry. You know, it's not going to cut it. I said, you know, it's like, what about the next guy? You know, so I'm like, no, man, I don't think she should be working here. You know, I wanted more. I wanted retribution. And suddenly, who is running the show? You know, it's me. And so the guy, the manager, said, look, I really don't want to have to do anything. He said she had had like a wedding ring stolen before work, and she's just working at her shift, and she's having a really bad day. And it's one of those moments of clarity, you know, where everything just stops, you know, on a dime, and you go, how far are you going to take this? You know, where are you going with it? You know, where is it going to end? Is this worth pursuing? You ass. and I'm like, no, just forget about it, you know? But at that moment, it was one of those moments of clarity where God just hit the brake. And he said, just look around you and see the big picture here, dude. You know, everything is not revolving around you. You're just not the center of the universe, you know? And it was at that moment I started to realize, now I wish I could take this into every day with me, but I started to realize every person that I tried to run off the road because they cut in front of me, you know, they had lives too. They had situations too, you know. They may have had people that needed to get to the hospital, you know. But the fact is that up until that moment, and a lot of moments since then, you know, everything that I encountered was filtered through how it affects me. You know, that's exactly how I looked at life, is how it affects me. And I was just slapped with it in the face. I kind of believe in today, it's kind of another analogy. My sponsor likes to call it the God line. And it's a good thing for Hugh to live by because it's simple, but effective. There's this imaginary God line, okay? And on this side of the God line is the things that Hugh is responsible for, okay? It's not a real big area, okay? It's just a small side of the street. And on this side of the line is everything God is responsible for, and it's broad, okay? And all of my life, I've been living over here on the wrong side of that line. Okay. See, I wanted to get paid for jobs that I didn't want to do. You know, I wanted all the results without any of the work. I wanted you to change, which is none of my business. You know, and while all my energy has been exerted on this side of the line, this side hadn't been getting done. Okay, and that's created a hell of a mess, even in sobriety. Living on the wrong side of the line. And, you know, every now and then, you know, my sponsor or I'll have to go, you know, which side of the line am I on here, you know? Because I can easily jump over here and the results in your business. And when really it's so simple because this side of the line pretty much adds up to the next right action, okay? That's really pretty much what this side of the line adds up to. And that's pretty simple. I heard a guy speak at IKIPA in Nashville, Lou M., and he had, like, a lot of sobriety. He's, like, the oldest sober person I had ever heard of. And this guy came in to IKIPA, and he had a young, sober, and free hat on. And he was in his 70s, and this is back in 88. And I can remember, and I remember thinking, man, you know, that's kind of strange. But the more I thought about it, the more it made sense to me. And he said, you know, sometimes the most important things he does during the day is to pick up coat hangers, you know, and to him that means so much. And I thought that's pretty stupid, but to him coat hangers was the perfect analogy for the next right thing, because inevitably he was in his closet getting something out and a coat hanger would drop and he would leave it and he'd go to the next thing, when really the next right thing was to pick up the coat hanger. He said, before long, the whole bottom of my closet is full of coat hangers. He said, which is exactly what happens in my life, is that I'm always looking for the next thing to make me feel okay and forgetting about what's right in front of me, what God has in store for me right now. See, the simple things is really God's will for me today may just be to get my ass up on time, get into work, wash the dishes when they're sitting there. You know, real simple stuff, okay? That I forget about because I'm thinking about me and what's down the line that's going to make you feel okay and fill that hole. Getting back to it, I worked through the steps with this sponsor, and he And it truly, truly, there was a change that took place. And, I wasn't walking on air, but I can remember at certain points working those steps where I was thinking, my God, I'm getting it, and it was only in retrospect that we ever see this stuff, and sometimes I cringe when we hear the promises because I'm like, oh my God, you work for the promises, and the promises are byproducts of right living, of a process that has been proven year after year after year after year to work, okay? And we do it because we see it in others, and we try it because we hurt. And we're willing to do whatever it takes, okay? And through willingness, we start getting the gifts at the exact increments and times that we're supposed to get them. Not before or not anymore than what we're supposed to get. And I have big problems with that, okay? Because I want what I want when I want it. And I want a lot of it. And that's just me. And, God's just got a different timetable for me. And, I'm glad it hasn't happened in any other way. I know some people say that, and I've heard before, and I totally believe in this, is if I would have come into the program and written down what I wanted out of this deal, I would have totally shortchanged myself. I would have got shot for all the wrong things, and come up way short, and I would have been miserable. Because I have no idea what makes Hugh happy in the long run, because I'm not given the full game plan, I'm just not up there in the huddle, with what's really going on. It's just, all I need to do is the next right thing and trust and start to try to develop each day a better dependence upon the God of my understanding. And I just have to work toward that. I have no idea when I'm supposed to end because I don't know when we started. And when I get ready, okay. Thank you. We'll be here a while, folks. Yeah. No, I'm getting ready. And so I work through the steps, and I have several times since. And I have a new sponsor today than I had then. I hit that point again later in my sobriety, I hit those certain points where, like I was telling you earlier, I start to feel real good, and things are flowing along real good, and I get complacent. And it happened to me probably at about 10 years. I was there again, and I was hurting. I was running the show. I didn't have a sponsor again. And my home group at that time was communications group in Nashville, and there was this guy in there. Man, he just hit me, everything he said, right on the head, man. And it was like, God. And the thing I really liked about this guy is that he practiced this deal every day, no matter if it rained, sun was shining, got up late, didn't matter. He had a routine that was in his life, and I no longer did. I had worked the steps, I'd arrived, and thank God, y'all, I had not arrived at those points in my sobriety, because I would have missed out on the gifts that I have today, God, when I just think, that I've gotten everything out of this deal, God just goes, no, you're not even close to being there, I'm going to start crying, I'm going to get to that point in a second, the stuff God's given me, but there was this guy, and the only problem with him is he had less sobriety than me, which isn't going to happen. This guy's not going to be my sponsor, Oh, man, he's going to listen to this CD, too. But I really respected him, I did. I mean, this guy worked the program, but he had a couple years less than I did, there again is the whole nature of the beast, It was just ego kept me from doing what I needed to do. So I needed to hurt a little bit longer. So I kept going to this home group, and I kept talking good things in meetings, saying I'm fine, spouting off the stuff that I had used to do when I was working the program, and listen to this guy and want what he had, in my life. And so I finally hurt bad enough, and I saw him after a meeting, and I said, I need you to work, with me on the steps. And I wasn't going to use the word, hey, you want me to sponsor you? Yeah. if you don't mind, you know. You know, and I'm thinking we can sponsor one another, and you know, yeah, still ego in there. But thank God I took that step, you know, because that was another level of humility I needed to get to. I needed to again say, I'm not doing it, you know. I'm not doing the deal. I am still running everything through me and to nobody else. I have no accountability, and I'm not asking for help anymore. I'm back to the problem. And so I needed to go through that again. So that's been about 6 or 7 years ago. I hope that's right, Dan. And thank God I went through that, because what I found working with him is really the beauty and the essence of this fellowship. It's what this program is all about. You know, this program isn't to be worked and then pat ourselves on the back, okay, and just kind of go off and do our deal. This program is to be lived. And to become a part of our lives, and so he helped me to do that. We worked through the steps again, and he started me doing the deal on a daily basis. And you know, I can say that I haven't started or ended my day since then without hitting my knees, without praying. And I had to go through all that to get to that point. And see, the problem with me in the past is I would do that for a period of time, and then I would stop, okay? And, you know, I guess things weren't happening fast enough, or I got busy again, or my life changed. But I started to think about it, and what I was doing is I was not giving God a chance, a true chance. I was giving God a period of time, and I was not practicing it as a way of life and allowing God to do with me on his timetable what needs to be done with me. And so I needed to get it away from whether remembering or not. And that's, I think, what this deal has to become for us. It has to become second nature. It has to become habitual, just like all the other crap I used to do was. My sponsor used to say this, and I used to go, yeah, right. But I would no more leave the house without praying, hitting my knees, and I would not wearing my pants, you know? And it had to become like that for me. It had to become like that. Because it takes it away from my will. It takes it away as a choice. See, if I don't do it today, it's not because I forgot. It's because I chose not to do it. And it had to get there. But I had to give it time. I had to give God time. And so so today my life is pretty simple, you know. I get up and I go to work and I try to be productive. Well, I get up, I do some readings, I hit my knees, I get quiet and I pray, and then I go out and start my day and inevitably take my will back a few times. But I try to do the next right thing, which is usually just simple stuff. You know, I try to make meetings, although not as many as I need to lately. But I still go, you know, I still go every week. And I try to make contact with my sponsor. I try to help another alcoholic, and I try to read a piece of the literature every day. My sponsor got me reading 2 pages of the big book. Every day. And that, I think that pretty much the first 164 pages, and I think that pretty much ensures that you'll go through that at least 2 or 3 times a year. And he figured that out. He's a smart man. But I do that, and that became a habit. And then I end my day on my knees again, thanking God for that day. And my life is good today. My life is better. It's not as eventful as I would have planned it. You know, it's not it's not as grand as some of the schemes I probably would have conjured up in my head, you know, of where I wanted to be right now. But there's no possible way that I would have been any happier than I am today. No way. I started, let's see. Oh, God. I had known somebody in the program for a while, and we had been friends, and we'd actually dated friends, and we started dating over 3 years ago now, and dated for over 4 years ago now. Sorry. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, right. Because we're engaged a year. Sorry. And we started dating officially. Actually, our first date was 4 years ago at Tiki Paw. But it was in February then. And that was like our first semi date. And then we went on a real date when we got home from Tiki Paw. But we started dating. And this is somebody that I had known in the program and had a real good friendship with. And we both kind of went our ways, and she went off to college, and we dated various people, and time went on, and God had a plan for us, so about 4 years ago, she came back from college, over 4 years ago now, she came back from college, and I had the good sense to ask her out, and we decided to go on our first date at Tiki Paw at the banquet 4 years ago. And then we started dating after Tiki Paw, and it was the smartest move I've ever made. You know, it was like all the things I had planned for myself, God just said, no, wait, there's something better, you know? I asked her to marry me a year later. It was the millennium, 2000, on the beach in Destin, and this is pretty good, guys. Give me some props, okay? But I had it planned out, and it was, like, killing me, you know, like, waiting for this moment. But, like, stroke of midnight, you know, fireworks went off over the ocean. I hit my knee and asked her to marry me. And thanks. I like to share it because it was a good moment for me. And a year later, we got married, and actually we celebrated our second-year anniversary in February, February the 3rd. I don't forget everything. And you would think that would be blessing enough, you know, for God to get you sober, you know, and then to go through all the pains, you know, and make you start to love yourself again and to feel good and enjoy life. And then he says, no, you know, here's a soulmate, you know, a person, you know, that complements you perfectly. And you'd think that would be enough, but 6 months ago we had our child, who's back there, who's here, who's there. Thank you. I was like, that's not my baby. That's her cousin. There she is. And it was just God saying again how much he loves me, you know? And that's really what this deal is all about, is I'm telling you, if you don't find God in this deal, you're doing shit way wrong. You know? Way wrong. And you are looking in all the wrong places, because God is everywhere. And every day I wake up, I have the opportunity to have a spiritual experience. And I screw that up a lot, but God keeps on blessing me and giving me another day sober and another day of a beautiful life. And I could not, as long as I live, be grateful enough for that. And none of my actions could ever exemplify the gratitude that I have. I heard somebody sometimes say, I used to hate gratitude meetings. I used to go, we had a meeting in Nashville called the gratitude meeting. And I don't know if anybody remembers that, but every week it was the same people, and they would think of like that week, the thing to be grateful for, you know, I got an A in class, you know, it was like, and I was like, this is old, you know? And so I hated gratitude meetings for a long time. It just seemed redundant to me. But I was in a meeting, and there was an old-timer in Florida, and his whole talk he gave was on gratitude. And he was the first person to really to make me understand of gratitude as an action, and that we live gratitude. And he talked about it as like getting a toolbox for Christmas, which I believe I've been given as a set of tools. getting a toolbox for Christmas and going, man, thanks. These are the best damn tools I've ever seen. I can do a whole lot with these, you know. And then you go and put them in the storage room and never look at them again, you know. And the fact is if I'm grateful for that, I'm using that to good purpose. If I'm grateful for those tools. And if I'm grateful for the tools I have today and that I've been freely given through a loving God, then I need to be using those. And I need to be practicing this deal one day at a time. And I'm really grateful to have been given this opportunity. And it's a great honor. And I appreciate y'all sitting there and being attentive to me. Thank you. I love y'all.